1101E. Good morning. You've queued up the audio version of today's Offbeat Oregon Du Jour entry. Offbeat Oregon Du Jour is an RSS service that brings you a new story from the archives of the Offbeat Oregon History newspaper column every day in your choice of text and images or audio-only format. And you're listening to the audio version right now. Offbeat Oregon Du Jour brings you true stories from Oregon history. Stories of heroes and rascals, of shipwrecks and lost gold, of Shanghai'd sailors and Skid Row bordellos and pirates and robbers and buried treasure and unsolved mysteries, and all sorts of great stuff like that. To get these delivered regularly, direct your podcatcher to ofor.us/p-podcast and subscribe. If you'd rather read them and see the pictures that go with them while you're waiting in line at Starbucks, direct your newsreader to ofor.us/t. The audio version, which you're listening to now, is super simple. Just me reading you the column. No bumper music, no sound effects, no dog, no pony. And also, if the movie ratings people were going to rate Offbeat Oregon Du Jour, they'd probably give it a PG. Most folks will find it suitable for family listening. Our column was first published on January 30th, 2011. Its headline is Japanese Submarine Blasted Its Way Into Oregon History Twice. The summary. The Big Sub was a key part of Oregon history. It fired on Battery Russell in June 1942, tried to light a forest fire with its onboard airplane that September, and sank several merchant ships. Here's the article. In late August 1943, the crew of the destroyer USS Patterson scrambled to battle stations off the coast of what is now Vanuatu, near Australia. The sonar operator had picked up the signature of a big Japanese submarine close by. The Patterson steamed into battle, depth charges rolling off the deck and lighting up the sea below. Then, on the final depth charge barrage, a deep undersea explosion could be heard, bigger than any depth charge. The Patterson had found its mark. After that day, the most important submarine in the history of the state of Oregon, the Imperial Japanese Navy's I-25, was never heard from again. The I-25 was one of the large fleet subs the Japanese Navy put out to sea during the war. Built in 1939, the boat was 357 feet long and packed a large collection of torpedoes, a 5.5-inch deck gun, and even a fold-up seaplane. The reason the I-25 is so important to Oregon stems from a visit it paid to the Beaver State the year before it sank. In the course of that visit, the I-25 sank two merchant ships, shelled a coastal battery, and sent its airplane ashore to try and start a forest fire. It left Oregon not that much the worse for wear, but the psychological effect was considerable, as Oregonians wondered if this were just the beginning, and realized they were on the front lines. It wasn't just the beginning, of course. The beginning of anything. It was just a single submarine. A single, very busy submarine. The I-25 left Yokosuka, Japan, in the spring of 1942, and headed east across the Pacific Ocean, headed for Alaska and points south. 2 months and one heavily damaged Canadian freighter later, on the night of June 21, 1942, the sub was following a fleet of fishing boats toward the mouth of Columbia River. It followed the fishing boat so that if anyone picked up its signature on a radar, they'd think it was just another fishing boat. When it got within range, the boat swung around and the gun crews got the deck cannon ready. Sub-commander Meiji Tagami had somehow gotten the impression that there was a submarine base at the mouth of the Columbia and, although not willing to risk his crew and mission getting close enough to see for sure, thought a few artillery shells placed in the vicinity would send a valuable message to the Americans. So, under cover of darkness, miles out to sea, the I-25 opened fire. And for the first time ever, the state of Oregon was directly attacked by a wartime enemy. As it turned out, the place the I-25 was shelling was not a sub base. It was Battery Russell at Fort Stevens, and the hostile shellfire had an immediate effect on the place. Soldiers and officers leaped out of bed and started running around trying to get ready to go help return fire, in the dark, of course. People tripped over stoves and crashed into trucks and cursed at one another as they scrambled to their battle stations in their underwear. "We looked like hell," Captain Jack R. Wood, commander of the battery, told historian Bert Weber later. "But we were ready to shoot back in a couple minutes." Soon the gunners were ready, but the orders were to hold their fire. This was for several reasons. First, the big 10-inch guns, designed to stop ships from coming into the Columbia, would not tilt up high enough to lob shells to the attacking submarine. The 12-inch mortars couldn't reach it either. Shooting back might have made the crews feel better, but it would only have revealed the gun's position, relative size, and range to a submarine that they were pretty sure was here on a reconnaissance mission. It could then go home and report that a nice big fleet of surface warships sitting 10 miles out to sea could pound Fort Stevens with impunity and then sail right up the Columbia River if it wanted to. Obviously, that could not be allowed to happen. So Fort Stevens sat there and took it. 17 shells in all, without so much as a pistol shot in reply. And eventually the I-25's crew got tired of shelling the dark and unresponsive mainland, put the gun away, and left. Behind it, the submarine left the smoking wreckage of a baseball diamond backstrap, some slightly damaged power lines, and a handful of holes in the ground. The total dollar amount of damage done was probably well under $20. On its next visit to Oregon, the I-25 did better, if better is the right word. It started out on March 9th by launching its onboard seaplane with a couple incendiary bombs and orders to use them to start a forest fire near Brookings. A few years earlier, the town of Bandon had been destroyed when a forest fire got into the gorse thickets and hedges that surrounded the town. Hoping to start something similar, Warrant Officer Nobuo Fujita buzzed inland in his tiny fold-up seaplane and gave it a shot, then came back a few days later and tried again. Nothing came of this. The forest was too damp for an out-of-control burn to get going, but then again, the I-25 was making history. It was the only wartime strike ever delivered on the American mainland, before or since. Between the airstrikes, Tagami's intrepid crew actually set the big sub down on the seafloor to make it less easy to detect. Several weeks later, the I-25 spotted a big merchant ship sitting still in the water. It was the SS Camden, which was taking a short break while its engineer took care of a couple minor repairs in the engine room. 60 seconds and two torpedoes later, the ship was on fire. It sank later when its cargo of gasoline exploded while it was being towed to Seattle for salvage. One crew member drowned. The following day, the submarine sank a second ship off Gold Beach, the SS Larry Doheny, an oil tanker. 6 people died on this one. After that, the I-25 returned to Japan, stopping along the way to fire its last remaining torpedo into a surfaced Russian submarine. It never returned to Oregon waters. That's it for today. You just heard Japanese submarine blasted its way into Oregon history twice by Finn J.D. John. That's me. I wrote and first published this on January 30th, 2011. If you'd like to see the art for this story or print out a hard copy for any reason, you can look it up on my website at www.offbeatoregon.com. That'll take you straight to a table of contents arranged in order of the date they're first published. Look for the January 2011 stuff, and you'll find it right there. Everything in the Offbeat Oregon history empire, if you will, is covered under a Creative Commons 3.0 share alike license, so if you want to use this for any purpose, please feel free, as long as you give proper credit. And that covers us until tomorrow, when we will be uploading our next edition, so look for it after about 6 a.m. And until then, have a great day, and, well, try to stay out of the obituaries, will ya?